It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So she just turned 22, newly recovered from COVID-19, athletic, been a swimmer, high school, college, healthy eater, daily exerciser, no underlying health problems. But the coronavirus was unlike any health challenge she's faced in her life. Have you or someone you know been diagnosed with the coronavirus? Where was testing done to get results? What do you want to know about the course of this disease? We're at 800-642-1234. Amy Chersell is a senior at UW-Madison studying political science and environmental studies. She spent nearly 2 weeks battling the infection. She got sick in early March after a spring break trip to Portugal that was cut short because of the U.S.-Europe travel ban. Amy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me.
Now that you've recovered, how does it feel to be out of isolation? What do you feel like today?
I feel so much better. I'm almost 2 weeks recovered right now. I'm feeling healthy. I have my strength and energy back. And for a while there, I forgot what it was like to be healthy. So I'm just really happy to have been lucky enough to recover. I think I had luck and health on my side.
And what does it mean that you are recovered? Like, what was the threshold there that you had to pass to say, I am recovered?
Yeah, so it's kind of vague. I talked to multiple doctors and I looked at the CDC guidelines. And basically it was 72 hours. No symptoms, no fever, anything like that. And then you were considered able to come in contact with people you were quarantined with and go about your daily life, even though daily life is not normal now. So it was vague, and we still don't know if I could spread anything, how clear I am. But 72 hours was the general threshold I was told.
So take us back to that time when you were so sick. What were your symptoms like?
Yeah, my symptoms when I was at my most sick was my fever was just so high. I was delirious. I couldn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I could barely drink water. I was so weak. I couldn't walk. I didn't trust myself to walk. I had no energy. I was sleeping all the time. I was either shivering under my blankets all day or sweating so much I had to sleep on towels. It was just awful. I never had shortness of breath as the most severe symptom, but it was definitely tightness in my chest. It made it harder to breathe for sure. I would shift positions in bed and have to catch my breath. So all of the above, all at once, was probably when I was at my most sick.
You also had symptoms that haven't been, more heavily talked about, like a vomiting and a runny nose.
Yeah, definitely. I have been reading different people's cases who had COVID-19 like I have, and there's actually a decent amount of people who have throwing up and diarrhea as a symptom, and that was also a prominent symptom for me, and it led to me being like just even more sick. I was dehydrated, I couldn't eat, and things like that. So I think it's important to spread the word about the vast array of symptoms you can get and how differently it affects everyone, and that you shouldn't discount your symptoms before you know if you have COVID-19 or not, because there's such a variety of how sick and how ill you can get.
We're talking with Amy Chersell. She's a senior at UW-Madison, recovered now from COVID-19, and she shared her experience and the details of that sickness on Twitter, and that went viral. Amy, who took care of you during this time?
Yeah, so the first 12 days that I was sick, I was alone in my Madison apartment. My family was being really careful just because my mom is immunocompromised with a heart condition after a heart attack in November. So we were being really careful. I wanted to stay away from them. It got to a point, though, where I was just so sick. I was begging my parents to come get me. And as soon as I got back to my parents' house, and I had someone looking after me and taking care of me, I immediately started to get better right away. So I'm really thankful for my parents for making that sacrifice and coming to get me after being alone for so long.
I understand you also went to the emergency room. What was that like?
Yeah, so I had really no other option. I was so dehydrated. I was so weak. I just felt like I needed medical attention. I was alone, and the unpredictable nature of COVID, you just really don't know what to do. And I was encouraged by my primary care doctor to go to the hospital. It's also hard because I was here alone and wasn't quarantined with anyone. I had no way to get to the hospital, so I had to call an ambulance, and they took me to the ER where I was rehydrated. I'm grateful that I have the ability to be able to go and get treated at the hospital in the ER and take an ambulance. It was just the whole experience is really dehumanizing. Everyone acts like you have the plague because you basically do. No one will touch you with a 10-foot pole without the proper PPE. There's a big sign on my door with a stop sign that said, do not enter. So it's really lonely and dehumanizing, and you don't know what it's like to have people act like that around you. I know it's no one's fault. It's no one's intention to make you feel that way, but it is hard, and it's just another thing on top of everything else you're going through.
You also received comments online as you were posting about your experience. What was that like?
Yeah, I received a lot of positive comments, but also so many negative comments. There was a lot of negative comments from strangers, which I guess you should just expect if you go viral like that. But also, just recently, the last couple of days, started to be people I know, my friends, which it was harder to ignore those comments. I got death threats. I was called some of the most horrible names. I was told I was too fat, and that's why I got sick. I was told that everyone wished I would have died from COVID. I was told it was karma. All the above, like the most terrible things. I was getting, at the peak, I was getting 100 messages an hour, and I deleted most of them. But it seems stupid because this is on the internet, but it eventually took a really big toll on me, and it's been hard the last couple of days trying to deal with all that. But I'm really lucky to have friends and family, and at the end of the day, my main reason for posting all of it on social media was to try to get the word out about advocating for people to stay home and just the fact that young people can get sick. And I wanted to not sugarcoat anything and tell how the virus affected me in the worst way. And I think I was also successful in getting that word out. I got so many responses from all over the world thanking me. So it makes it all worth it in the end.
And you also learned you can be a plasma donor.
Yes, I was so excited to learn. I think it was 2 days ago, I was sent an article about plasma donation in Madison. It's really experimental, so they're just in the first steps. I'm waiting for a call back right now about when I can first go get another test to test negative and then to donate plasma. It'll be easier for me because I actually was lucky enough to get COVID-19 test in the first place. They're still taking people who believe that they were sick with COVID but weren't able to get a test. So definitely if you're listening and you think you were sick but weren't able to get tested, check that out and call the UW hospital about that. But
well, Amy, thank you so much for joining us, and good to know that you are well again.
Thank you so much.
Amy Chersel is a senior at UW-Madison. Coming up, scientists and physicians around the world are racing to find new treatments, and UW Hospital has joined a project on the convalescent plasma project. We'll learn about it in a moment on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're learning about whether plasma infusions could help save coronavirus patients. The National COVID-19 Convalescent Plasma Project is 57 health institutions in dozens of states, and UW Hospital is part of the effort collecting plasma from recovered COVID-19 patients to help in treating those who are currently ill with the disease. What do you want to know about antibodies and fighting off COVID-19? Are you recovered and think you maybe will be able to be a donor? We're at 800-642-1234. Dr. William Hartman is an anesthesiologist at UW Health who is heading up the effort at UW Hospital, which is part of the national study. Dr. Hartman, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So how are you currently coping with the pandemic as someone who is in healthcare right now and healthcare being on the front lines? What is it like?
To be honest, there is a certain level of anxiety when you walk into the hospital. However, there are people that are doing checks as you walk into the hospital to make sure that you don't have a fever, that you're checking your symptoms. And they're the most pleasant people in the world who are always extremely nice, you know, giving you encouragement as you walk in. It kind of makes you feel like you're coming and you're going to do something good when you walk in. Like I said, though, there is a heightened level of anxiety, but this is what we were trained to do, and we have a job ahead of us, and this is what we're going to do.
So you're working with the National COVID-19 Convalescent Plasma Project, which is, you know, supposed to be pretty cutting edge here. Where does the research stand right now?
The research here at UW Health and UW School of Medicine and Public Health, we are just in the process now of screening our donors for COVID-19. Because the donors who were previously positive have to have a negative test now to be able to donate their plasma. We should get the first set of results back today, and then we will be setting those individuals up to donate blood and collect their plasma.
And what will happen after that, after you collect this plasma?
Sure. Then the plasma will be processed. They'll look for all the normal viruses that they typically do. It gets labeled specially because it is this special convalescent plasma containing the antibody that we want to go after COVID-19. We'll get that back at the hospital, and then we will have pre-approved patients who've been consented to be part of this study, and we will transfuse that plasma into them with the hopes that we can lessen the severity of their disease.
We're talking with Dr. William Hartman. He is an anesthesiologist at UW Health, leading this study there to determine whether plasma transfusions from people who have recovered from the coronavirus might help others recover from the illness. Your questions, they're welcome. Have you or someone you know been diagnosed with the coronavirus? Where was testing done to get those results, and how has it been for you? Have you been symptom-free for over 72 hours? May you think you might be a donor? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Hartman, this course of medical action here, what do we know about how plasma transfusions work? Has it been done anywhere else around the world?
Sure. So this is actually a back-to-basics type of project, back-to-basics type of science. The use of convalescent plasma goes back over 100 years, and it was used even in 1901 to fight diphtheria, in 1913 to combat the Spanish flu. More recently, it's been used to treat the coronaviruses known as SARS and MERS, and it's also been used to treat Ebola. And so we have quite a bit of history of using convalescent plasma to go after viruses and bacteria that we don't have vaccines for currently.
So in recent times, have they been trying this in China? What have been the results there?
Sure. So the only study that's been published to date on convalescent plasma use for COVID-19 came out of China. The study was encouraging, but it was only 5 patients. And so they gave convalescent plasma to 5 patients with life-threatening illness. They were ventilated. All 5 patients have been extubated, Three of them were discharged home, and the other two are still recovering. So at least the initial feeling is that the convalescent plasma will have a positive effect.
But isn't that a really small sample size?
It is a small sample size, but that, and along with the fact that we have no cure currently for the disease, what we do know is that people who get infected with COVID-19 develop this antibody. And the best thing that we have to combat that COVID-19 is this antibody. And so we know that the antibody has killed off the virus in the individual who's recovered. And so that superpower, that antibody that they have, could be used in a person who's still fighting the disease, who has a worse severity of the disease. We give them that antibody, knowing that it's worked once and hoping that it works again.
Take us inside the body and help us understand what antibodies are, how this blood protein is produced and what it does.
Sure. So the antibody is a defense mechanism that's created by the body to fight foreign invaders, if you will. The foreign invader in this case is the COVID-19. And the COVID-19 virus itself has on its surface what are called antigens, or things that the body can recognize as like bumps or peaks. And it can develop antibodies to these antigens so that it's kind of like a big brother grabbing the little brother by the neck of his shirt and holding him back. And then that's kind of what the antibody does. It neutralizes that antigen, it neutralizes that virus. It hangs on to it and then lets the body's immune system eliminate the virus from the system.
So it keeps that bad thing, that foreign substance, at bay while the body can do its normal processes to get back and stabilized.
That's absolutely correct.
So after someone recovers from the coronavirus, or any virus for that matter, how long do these helpful antibodies stick around in the plasma?
I think that's one of the million-dollar questions that needs to get answered. For the coronavirus, for COVID-19, we don't really know how long those antibodies will stay in the system. What we feel is that as a patient recovers, over time, the titer or the amount of antibody that they have probably does decrease. And so for the donors that we're targeting to get their plasma, we're hoping that they're somewhere between 14 days after symptoms to 28 days after symptoms, thinking that in that time period, the titer of antibodies will still be high enough. We predict that it will be high enough that it'll be an effective treatment.
Are there potential risks here to this treatment, even though it's been around, this type of treatment has been around for over 100 years?
Right. With any experimental treatment, there's always risks. The biggest risk, and the one that probably keeps me up at night as I go through this study, is that it won't work. We don't have enough of a population sample at this point who's been treated with convalescent plasma to know that it will work. We have some anecdotal data suggesting that it will, but we don't know. Other risks that are possible but very low have to do with the transfusion itself. Anytime you give a transfusion, there's always a chance that you could that the body could have a reaction to that. We call those transfusion reactions. And they can be as minor as developing a slight fever to anaphylaxis. But especially with plasma, where the red cells are extracted from the solution, that's a very low risk, but it's a risk that does exist.
So I understand 57 institutions are involved here. The Mayo Clinic has a lead. Johns Hopkins has a lead here. How is everyone staying on the same page?
So we have weekly check-in meetings. So actually we have one this afternoon where everyone who's a PI within the consortium.
Principal investigator.
So that they we can discuss things that are working, things that maybe aren't working, things that are coming down the pipeline, with the goal that that all 57 institutions are hearing the same information, and we can really tailor the best treatments at our institutions for us here at University of Wisconsin.
We're talking with UW Health anesthesiologist William Hartman about this nationwide effort to collect antibodies from the blood of recovered coronavirus patients. What do you want to know about the National COVID-19 Convalescent Plasma Project? Do you think researchers are pushing in the right direction? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll talk more with Dr. Hartman after this news update on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Quick programming note here. You can find the latest coronavirus news and a hive of related stories and analysis. That's all at our website, wpr.org/COVID. Right now, we're talking about plasma collected from people who have recovered from COVID-19 during this public health emergency. Are you someone who is part of testing for the coronavirus? What should people understand about the process? How much has evolved over the past few weeks? Are you part of the Convalescent Plasma Project at Mayo in Minnesota or another institution? How's it going? Join in 800-642-1234. We have Dr. William Hartman of UW Health, who is part of this national study effort, and he stays with us. Dr. Hartman, we heard from Paul in Slinger, who's called in with several questions. He couldn't stay with us. He wants to know, first of all, how does it work to get the plasma from the blood? Do you have to use a centrifuge? He'd also like to know how much plasma you need and how many people can be treated with it.
Sure, those are all excellent questions. There is a special plasma extracting machine, if you will, called the Alex, that's utilized by the American Red Cross, and it actually can separate the plasma from the cells as the blood is being collected. And that's the method that we'll be using here in Madison through the American Red Cross.
And go ahead.
In terms of how much plasma can be collected, usually in one unit of blood that would be collected, we're able to extract approximately 600 to 650 milliliters or cc's of plasma, which would be enough to treat 2 to 3 patients.
Okay. Let's bring in Richard now in Colfax. Hi, Richard.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You've got me with a mouthful of breakfast. I have a question. I'm 84 years old, and when I was in college in Kaukauna, Wisconsin, where I grew up, I rode to work each day in a summer job with my brother, and then he contracted polio. This was when polio was quite prevalent in the late 50s, and I received a phone call at work one day saying that after work I should go right to the doctor's office and I would get a shot of gamma globulin because my brother had polio and I had close contact with him. I received that gamma globulin with a needle and a syringe, not a transfusion, but I was told that the antibodies from someone that had polio and recovered were in that gamma globulin. Do you know anything? Is that the same, actually the same thinking, the same basic procedure?
That is exactly the same thinking, where they took the antibodies that fought off the polio in that one individual. They know that antibody worked, that antibody was able to neutralize and fight off the polio in the first person. And the hope then is that the antibody would be equally effective in you. The difference there, though, is that while you were exposed to polio, you didn't have the manifestations of it. So you didn't maybe have the virus, or you had it at a very low level. And that is an interesting concept, and one to think about for a future study is in people who have been exposed to COVID-19, to the coronavirus, if we give those people where they've been exposed but they don't necessarily have any symptoms, if we give them plasma that has the COVID antibody in it, will we be able to prevent that person from developing the symptoms of disease?
So
very good concept.
Lots to watch for there. Richard, thank you so much for sharing your experience. Let's go to Sorrel now, joining us from Madison with a question. Hi, Sorrel.
Hi. I saw something on, some friend of mine posted something on Facebook about the O blood type being like less likely to get the COVID virus. Is there anything to that, or is that just complete nonsense?
So I don't know that that's complete nonsense. And I don't know if having the O blood type necessarily means you're less likely to develop COVID-19. A study, and I don't know if this was just preliminary work or if this was actually published from Mayo Clinic, showed that individuals with an A blood type would be more susceptible to developing COVID-19 disease. Again, that's a small sample size. It's a single study. But that does seem to be something that has been true before, and it seems to be holding true again. So I can't comment specifically on O blood type, but it does seem that individuals with A blood type might be more susceptible to developing disease.
Well, Sorrel, thank you so much for that question. We're talking with Dr. William Hartman, who works at UW Health. He's an anesthesiologist studying how plasma from recovered COVID-19 patients can help treat patients currently with the virus. Your questions about this study, about the research that's underway, it's welcome at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. Hartman, as you said earlier, that principal investigators come together on these conference calls, Zoom calls, regularly. How are other institutions, where are they at in the process of collecting plasma and trying to do these infusions?
Sure. So institutions around the country are at different points right now. The consortium itself was only developed about a month ago, and truly in the last 2 weeks, 2 to 3 weeks, momentum has picked up where other institutions have joined the consortium. And then it does take some time to build the program at whatever institution you're at. We are blessed here at University of Wisconsin that we had absolutely the best and the most motivated team of physicians, scientists, administrators, coordinators who came together with the single purpose of getting this program up and running in Madison so that we could get this treatment for our patients. The fact that we were able to establish this program and do it so quickly speaks extremely highly of the people that work here, and I truly believe represents the best of Wisconsin and the best of University of Wisconsin.
I understand, too, that you're not just looking for plasma donors who are in the Madison area, but you are extending this call all over the state and even out of state.
Sure. And I think that holds true throughout the country, that even if the plasma doesn't come here to University of Wisconsin, the plasma will go to somebody who needs it. And American Red Cross is setting up those avenues to get to be able to build the bank of convalescent plasma and transfuse it into people that need it throughout the country.
And how do you transport this convalescent plasma? How do you arrange for that? And how soon after you get it do you have to use it?
So those are the transportation and storage works through both American Red Cross and the blood banks at your institution as to how you receive it. The plasma itself is frozen, and it comes to the institutions as frozen and can actually be stored up to 36 months.
Wow. So it has quite a bit of shelf life. It's not like you have to get it out of a person and put it into a patient right away.
That's correct.
Do you have any idea on the history of these transfusions, how much good evidence out there from these different health crises over those more than 100 years? How successful were they? And does the data back that up? Was there good data that you could rely on over 100 years ago and even maybe 50 years ago?
Well, certainly in 1913, when it was used to treat the Spanish flu, the individuals that used convalescent plasma were able to reduce the severity and the morbidity and mortality associated with the Spanish flu and received the Nobel Prize for it. So the data that they had and the results that they had were proven and excited the world stage enough that they received the biggest prize in science and medicine. More recently, again, the studies that are published are smaller for Ebola, for MERS, and for SARS, but the data that we do have is good data, and there's enough positive there to make us believe that we'll be able to lessen the severity of COVID as well.
So that history really helps inform how you go forward and even how much confidence you have in this type of mode of treatment.
Correct. And again, it's an experimental treatment. So we don't know that it's going to work. We don't know that it's going to be a cure. What we do have is tremendous hope based on the history of using convalescent plasma to treat viruses and other diseases. We believe that given that history, that we can truly have hope and be excited that we have something that could be an effective treatment.
Talking with Dr. William Hartman, he's working to determine how plasma of recovered patients can help treat patients with COVID-19. What do you want to know about antibodies and fighting off COVID-19? What do you want to know about this project? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So the use of antibody-rich convalescent plasma to treat or prevent serious infections has been part of medical practice, as we learned, for more than a century. Fast forward to today, as thousands of people have registered to donate plasma as part of the next step to advance the use of convalescent plasma for the treatment of COVID-19 infection. And we have UW Health anesthesiologist William Hartman this hour as our guide. He's working to treat patients with COVID-19 as part of a national study effort. Let's take another call now. Shane is joining us from Eau Claire with a question. Hi, Shane.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. If I remember my high school biology correctly, things like other viruses like the common colds, you don't actually ever get cured from. It just goes into dormancy or it just flares up. So does that mean that even though people are overcoming COVID and they get better, that, you know, it's still in their system somehow and that there's really an inevitability that everybody's going to get sick from it eventually?
Well, I don't think that everybody will get sick from it eventually. At least I hope that people don't. does it stick in your system? Does the COVID-19 stick in your system? I think that that's one of the million-dollar questions that we have right now. Is it, does it stay around and then cause the person to get sick again later? We don't truly know the answer to that. The symptoms and the disease that's caused by COVID-19 hasn't been around long enough for us to get to develop all the data on it. There is some indication in China that some people are able to get reinfected with it. Again, we don't have good scientific data to back that up right now. So these are all things that we're going to have to investigate scientifically to build a better story so that we know how to attack this at a later time if it does come up.
Shane, thank you for the call. We also heard from John in Thorpe, who called in to ask, how often can recovered patients donate, and can they donate at any Red Cross location, or does it have to be a very special site?
So if you have had a positive test for COVID-19, for the coronavirus, and you are 28 days past symptoms, then you can go to the American Red Cross page and sign up to be a convalescent plasma donor. They have a special page set up for that. And their schedulers then will get a hold of you and schedule a time for you to have your plasma extracted, collected.
Is this go ahead.
Go ahead.
Is plasma donation like this, is it practical for treating large numbers of people in a pandemic?
Well, that's a good question. Currently, the pool of donors isn't huge. And that is, we're limited by the fact that the donors have to have had a positive COVID-19 test. There's a still, even though that population is increasing and our testing is becoming more robust, the people who were originally suffering from infections, a lot of them weren't tested initially. And so, like I said, the current pool is smaller, but we anticipate that as this virus progresses, that donor pool will increase quite a bit. As the donor pool increases, we will have more opportunity to collect convalescent plasma and treat people. So really the biggest limitation in a study like this, the biggest limitation in a therapy like this is the available plasma.
Yeah. Let's look for a moment, because you are an anesthesiologist, let's talk just a moment here about intubation. Anesthesiologists intubate patients who need to be put on a ventilator. How often are we seeing the need for a ventilator in COVID-19 cases?
Sure. So the number of patients who are hospitalized is still a small percentage compared to the number of patients who are infected with COVID-19. And of the hospitalized patients, a smaller subset yet are the ones that have to be intubated and ventilated. These are the scarier situations because these patients are truly struggling to breathe, and their lungs are filling up with a fluid, and it does it quite rapidly. The process of going on a ventilator is something that anesthesiologists deal with daily. We use ventilators in our daily practice. The methods of ventilation, we have very experienced ICU and critical care physicians that are managing those ventilators, trying to find the best parameters to treat these people and wean them from or get them to come off of the ventilator as quickly as possible.
What's the risk that patients on ventilators will stay on that ventilator for the rest of their lives?
Well, certainly there's some risk. The patients who are going on ventilators tend to be the sickest of the patients who have COVID-19. The patients that are passing away from this disease, a lot of them were ventilated patients. So when you go on a ventilator, the disease has progressed to a point where it's in a life-threatening situation.
This procedure also puts the healthcare workers at risk. What are hospitals doing to protect anesthesiologists who are performing intubation?
So it is a little different from institution to institution. I know that our leadership, both at the university level and within our department, have for well over a month been planning and preparing anesthesiologists and people who intubate patients who have COVID-19 for this. And so the process does require you to be in full PPE, which includes shoe covers, which includes a surgical gown, or what looks like a spacesuit, even, to protect you from the aerosol that is generated when you intubate a patient. Other precautions that we use here, there are only limited number of people allowed in the room when an intubation takes place. All non-essential people to that procedure are asked to step out, and we try to really limit the traffic around the intubation itself.
How many people do you need on hand to perform the intubation?
Typically, there will be an anesthesiologist here at University of Wisconsin, and then another anesthesia provider, whether it be an anesthesia resident or a person who's training to be an anesthesiologist, a physician who's training to be an anesthesiologist, or a certified nurse anesthetist or an anesthesiology assistant. All of these people have been trained for years to do intubations. There'll likely be a respiratory therapist in the room as well, and the respiratory therapist will assist you in setting up the ventilator settings so that you can quickly go from intubating the patient to hooking them up to the ventilator.
Dr. Hartman, thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for having me and for getting the word out. I just want people to know that if they have had COVID-19, these are our heroes. They've got the superpower, and they've got this antibody that can help save someone else. And we'd be very grateful for a donation of that plasma. We know that it's worked in you. We really hope it's going to work in somebody else.
And we have a link to this information at our website at WPR.org/mornings. That is Dr. William Hartman, an anesthesiologist at UW Health. Earlier, we talked with Amy Schersell, a UW-Madison student who has recovered from the coronavirus. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.